Shooting it raw?
Yes. Shooting it raw.
Yeah, so photography. I mean, so I guess I've had a little bit more experience with photography now, having started written a cookbook, and I decided to cook everything and do all the photography myself, which is something that I'm not trained in. But I guess it's an interesting way to express yourself. And I found the sort of taking many, many pictures and choosing the good ones route was the way I was able to do it. And it's interesting, I guess, the difference that you find, and this is food photography, in the background, the setting, the lighting, it just makes a massive difference. Whereas I went into it thinking this is probably, you know, get a great camera and you're going to get great photos. It's actually the setup that I found really mattered. So I guess, yeah, you could say that my admiration for professional photography has gone up after doing this myself.
Nice. Matthew Habshawa, welcome back. Welcome back.
Thank you.
You look great. Welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks for having me. You don't often get invited back, do you?
Well, you know, you're always welcome. And the last conversation we had was really great. And I had no, like, I don't know what my guests are going to talk about. And I didn't expect that you're going to talk about a cookbook, which is like a hard left from what in my brain, I kind of associate with you. And so just for some, I have to set up the episode a little bit in the sense that, okay, fundamentally what I ask is, you know, how do we make every second count? Right. And then we met, you're in the UK. Are you actually in London?
I'm just outside of London, Essex.
Okay. And I'm in Hong Kong. And so look, I mean, you're a smart cookie. I really admire your thinking and your work. And I don't know what you have in store, but look, I'm really, really happy to see you again.
Great. So you haven't seen the photos?
I never do. I never look beforehand.
Okay, so you keep them a secret. Okay, that's nice. That's good.
Maybe that's actually really stupid of me because I don't research my guests. I'm just like, I go in like a naive idiot, you know, and I'm just like, okay, what can you teach me?
Yeah.
This is great. It's a diagram. You did this the last time. So it's a diagram. On the left, it says the carbon footprint of food. Oh, fuck, I love this. And on the right, it says global greenhouse gas emissions. And it's like a pencil drawing, like a kind of like a pie chart-ish kind of thing. Well, a donut chart, an exploded donut. There's a lot to describe because the carbon footprint of food has 1, 2, 3, 7 or so little sections. Buying choices, which is about 10%, cooking choices, which is about 20%, and then food processing and agriculture and land use is another, or food choices is 70%. So that's about your carbon footprint.
Yep.
And then on the right, global greenhouse gas emissions, there's like a gray section, which is transport, industry, amenities. And then you've got the other exploded sections, which are like deforestation, let's see, ruminant burps, yep. Of course.
Yeah.
And farts, I imagine, and energy use, global greenhouse gas emissions. Okay, Matthew, what have you done? What is this?
There's a lot when you can't see it.
Right? I love it. Go for it. What is this?
Okay, so last time I was on, we were talking about my last book, which was Climate Change and the Road to Net Zero, which was a serious old book, and I gave you four pictures of some serious pie charts, bar charts, whatever they may have been, and we were talking about, you know, the science, technology, economics and politics of climate change and how we get to a low carbon economy, a low carbon society. And kind of out of that book was born the idea of my recent book, which is a bit more fun, has been a fun project for me, which is actually a cookbook. And it all really comes down to this pie chart that you're looking at.
Yep.
And there's lots going on there, but it, in very simple terms, writing that first book made me realize agriculture is super important.
Right.
So there are four major sectors in the economy which emit greenhouse gases. Agriculture is one of them, and it accounts for about a quarter of all the emissions that go into the atmosphere and cause climate change.
Wow.
And the problem is that agriculture is a little bit different. So my last book, I was looking at all the options of how we solve climate change, whether it's worth it, should we do it, how much is it going to cost, what can we do, what are our options. And actually, in things like that you just mentioned, transport, amenities, which is like heating and cooling your house, cooking, and then transport and industry, you've actually got loads of commercially available technology already out there which can switch away from fossil fuels and get us to net zero, and it can actually do it at a very reasonable price. And mm-hmm. I actually think the whole net zero system, you'll not only eliminate greenhouse gas emissions, but it'll end up cheaper for the consumer because this technology is just getting so cheap so quickly.
Yeah.
But agriculture was a little bit different. And I hadn't appreciated this going into that book. But, you know, agriculture, the emissions there aren't from burning fossil fuels so much as direct emissions from the other things that you mentioned, deforestation.
Mm-hmm.
When you cut down a forest, you burn the trees, the trees rot and the CO2 emissions go up in the atmosphere and you're no longer storing them. Things like cow burps, or as you point out, farts. So these are ruminants like cows and sheep. The way they digest food is different and they belch out methane, mm-hmm. which is a very potent greenhouse gas. It's 30 times worse than CO2. And, you know, I went into writing that book. No, I knew about it, but I thought, cow burps. You know,
yeah.
Come on, that's just a sideline issue that makes a headline because it's funny. It's actually nearly as big as deforestation. It's nearly 5% of all global emissions.
Wow.
This is serious stuff, right?
Yep.
And then there's various other bits like using too much fertilizer and the way rice paddies are dried down and things like that. And what you realize coming away from that is that it's going to have to be a very different way that you get agriculture to net zero. You can't just throw technology at it.
Mm-hmm.
And that brings me on to the other pie chart there, which is showing you where the emissions on a plate of food come from. Mm-hmm. So if I asked you, like, without looking at that chart, where do you think the carbon footprint of the food that you eat comes from? What are the top one or two items that cause it?
I would think it's things like machinery to harvest, and maybe just because I think a lot of land, because I think a lot of the sort of ways of harvesting or whatever is really, I mean, you're always hearing about land being used and being kept expanding for agricultural use, right? So yeah. Deforestation, I guess, is just to create more land and then burning and whatever. So that's my quick, put me on the spot. That's what I'd say.
No, 100%. And you've nailed it on the head.
Oh.
I didn't want you to nail it on the head because when I had these conversations with most people, they say food miles, like transporting food around the world,
yeah,
or the way that you cook it. And actually, these are the ones that the stories get written on, the headlines get made on, you know, oh no, we're importing avocados from Mexico and
right.
shipping them around the world, and this is terrible. And, you know, things can always be done better. But if you look at the breakdown, which is in that chart, so buying choices, which is like transport and packaging, so where you're buying it from or where it's come from originally, and packaging the food, that's about 10% of the carbon footprint of food.
Right.
Cooking choices, so how you cook it, electric, gas, barbecue, whatever it may be. And then overeating and waste. So again, these are cooking choices.
Sure.
You choose how much to put onto your plate and how much you can eat. Combined, they're about 20% of the emissions. The other 70%, as you say, it's all down to the land use, the way it's processed and produced.
Mm-hmm.
And these are what I call food choices, because
right.
these are fundamentally dependent on the types of ingredients that you're choosing. And sort of putting these two bits together, so like agriculture is super important, food choices are the most important lever to reducing agricultural emissions, you realize then that it's not technology that's going to solve this, but it requires cultural change in what we eat. Mm-hmm. And so really that was the idea behind me writing a cookbook. You know, I wanted to show that you can still, you know, there are ways of cooking where you can reduce the carbon footprint, not by changing your oven or by buying different, buying from different shops or making sure you don't have food miles. But the biggest fundamental driver is in choosing what you eat and what the ingredients are.
So the ingredients, right.
Exactly. Ingredient choices.
Yeah, because I mean, I think just as a person who is a conservationist and who cares and, you know, who's kind of a little bit aware of this stuff, I mean, I know that, like, for example, people really love almond milk. And yep. You know that almond milk has, like, almonds and the heart, all that. So, I mean, I don't know if that's even picking the right thing. I mean, I don't know if meat is by far the most problematic ingredient. But yeah, like I'm aware of the fact that what you choose as an ingredient is going to have a huge impact.
Absolutely. But I think people are becoming aware of that. As you say, they know meat is kind of bad, but perhaps they don't know how bad and what meats.
Right.
So I actually came out of the last book and I realized, actually, I'd gone into it thinking, you know, all of these guys who care about climate change and say that veganism or going vegetarian is the biggest change you can make. I'd always sort of scoffed at that. Mm-hmm. And coming out of actually looking at the numbers and looking at how we get to net zero, absolutely, eating a plant-based diet is the biggest change that you can make.
Right.
In terms of a personal change. A cultural change that you can make. So you know, to give you an idea of that, you know, the average diet for an average human being in the planet requires about one football pitch of farmland to grow all the crops, to graze the animals, etc., etc. If you go vegan, you only need a penalty box to grow all the food that you need all year round.
Right.
So it comes back to this land use change. So if everyone on the planet went vegan, suddenly we could reforest. Not only do the emissions go down because you're having to farm less land, so emissions mm-hmm. would go down ongoing instantly by like 75%, but also you would have so much freed up land that you no longer need that you could replant trees on that land, and you could replant enough trees to sequester, to draw down all the CO2 that humans have ever put into the atmosphere, ever.
Right.
Completely. That's how powerful it is.
Yeah, very powerful.
So I went vegan after writing the book.
Of course.
But so I didn't go fully vegan. I went vegan 4 days a week, which I know is not vegan to all the vegans listening, but...
You know, the Buddhist in me would say, just do your best. You know, like life is hard enough. Just do your best. Yeah. Even that,
so that is
huge.
Yeah.
And on that very lighthearted note, let's go on to the next image. Okay, another graphic. I love the fact that. You know, my little momentum steam train, whatever, is about the photographs. But then, yeah, why not? Who cares? Let's use these graphics. It's perfect. So this is just a standard kind of graph with the sort of the y-axis is carbon footprint, kilograms of CO2 per kilograms of food, or CO2 energy, yep. I guess?
Of CO2 emissions.
Emissions. And on the x-axis is meat. So you have beef mince, lamb, pork loin, chicken breast, chicken thigh. And clearly the largest sort of bar is beef, T-bone steak. And then as you go down the list, I mean, the chicken thigh, which is the, you know, relatively lowest. So what are you saying?
Yeah, so this is back to our conversation on the magnitude of these different things. So, mm-hmm. you know, so I went, as I say, I went vegan half the week.
Yeah.
Because on my numbers, you know, if everybody did that, that's enough to get to towards net zero agriculture.
And by the way, I have to say this. I have to interrupt. You're with friends. I'm on your side. I'm with you now.
Yeah.
If you looked at my diet, it is effectively vegan for half the week. Like, just do your best. So listen, I understand who you are.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's how it is in my house. So yeah.
But so, keep going. I've got an admission to make. I did my best, but it probably only lasted 6 months.
Okay.
And then I gradually started just falling back into my old eating habits.
Well, you know, there are patterns. Okay.
Yeah. Which is kind of what led me to think, well, okay, but can we do this differently? Instead of being vegan half the week, you know, my usual diet the other half of the week, can we just do the whole week but do it better?
Right.
So
okay.
Can I create meat-based dishes that are low carbon? Which led me on to thinking, can I create classic recipes that everybody regularly cooks at home, but can I make them dramatically lower carbon? And kind of that was the idea for where the cookbook came, because
nice.
it wasn't going well for me being a vegan. I couldn't stick to it.
Poor thing.
I'm weak-willed.
No, well, look, I also think that I've been having a lot of arguments or discussions with people about how we don't have free will, right?
Yeah.
Like that from a neurobiological point of view, it's really hard to prove that we have free will. And so feeding into that, pun intended, is that what happens if you go 6 months and then you're just like, I need a steak. Like and in your head, it's just like, oh, I just miss the flavor or whatever. But what happens if there's something that you can't affix a sentence to that is more, you know, that is neurochemical, that is...
Yeah.
But I'm sure somebody who's fully vegan is going to be like, you bastard, you don't know nothing. But anyway, so as you were saying, I interrupted you, and that's how I am as an interviewer. You decided to remake these recipes.
Yeah, touching on that, because I'm actually, that's something I'm quite interested in, is free will, reality, consciousness. And I'm listening to a podcast at the moment on quantum consciousness.
Right.
So it sounds like you've taken quite a reductionist view of free will, in that we form our consciousness from electrons and neurons firing around our brain, which are physical things, and therefore there's knock-on effects and it's Newtonian, and how can there be free will?
Right.
You want to listen to quantum consciousness and the probabilistic quantum world where nothing's set in stone until we interact and measure it. And
okay.
That's how you start forming a view of free will and consciousness and science that we understand about. We don't understand, but we know about and we use.
I love it.
That might be a little tip for you.
but we digress.
And as an aside from quantum consciousness,
yeah,
we need to talk about beef. And steak,
yes.
And chicken and vegetables. So I put that chart on there very simply because this gives you a range of a scale, the scale of the whole thing. So the T-bone steak is the worst. Or what's that about? I can't remember. It's 50.
It's like 80-something.
80-something kilograms of greenhouse gas emissions per kilogram of steak. Why? Because cows use loads of land, which means loads of deforestation. They have these ruminant burps, which is that methane, mm-hmm. sort of direct emissions as well. And then thirdly, they take a long time to mature, and that means lots of feed through their lives. So of all the crops we grow on the planet, half of them we consume, the other half we feed to animals, but we only get about 10% of the calories back. So you know, rearing animals, rearing them for a long time is hugely inefficient. But then if you compare that beef and lambs, pretty bad. Lambs on there, it's about 25. But then you go all the way down and you start to see, well, pork is maybe around 5 to 7, chickens around 3 to 4. And then it's maybe not on that chart, but a vegetable's around 1.
Right.
So this is the kind of magnitude, the scale of things, right? So you really want to be avoiding beef and lamb. Actually, pork and chicken aren't that bad if you're eating them in smallish quantities, as you would for a protein, that's recommended. And this was actually another amazing thing that I found out when writing the book. So I wanted to also look at the dietary side of it and the recommended intake of calories. And actually it's recommended, you know, and these are government health guidelines, UK, US. It's actually recommended that about you're only meant to get about 10% of your calories from protein.
Right.
30% of your calories from fat, which really surprised me. And then the rest from carbohydrates. So I always had it in my head that a good diet was protein heavy.
And right.
I think it's kind of maybe a gym culture that we have in the UK or something that's kind of ingrained that into us, that protein is good, carbs are bad, fat's definitely bad. Actually, you need balance. You want to avoid saturated fat, but unsaturated fat is you know, that needs to be, you know, nearly a third of our calorie intake.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you have this... And you say, you mentioned almonds as being, you know, you feel guilty for eating almonds because they've had bad press around them, and that's because of water use and the where they're farmed, and you know, it's a lot of them come from California, I think, don't they? Avocados are another sort of vilified fruit and veg because they come from Mexico. There's cartels moving in. They consume a lot of water again. There's been, you know, articles about mini earthquakes. And yes, you know, some of the supply chains around this vegan type foods, there's been exponential growth in the consumption of things like avocados and almonds. And whenever something grows very quickly, supply chains get strained and you start to get these problems. But that's fixable. If you look at it on a fundamental basis, let's look at the carbon emissions of an imported avocado coming from Mexico into the UK. Yeah, it's probably about 2 kilograms of CO2 per kilogram of avocado.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's twice as bad as your average bit of fruit and vegetable, which is about 1. But it's still half as much as chicken or pork and 10 times less than beef or lamb.
Yeah.
So you can see how you can form a simple set of rules to make sure that, you know, you're cooking is very much low carbon. And, and so we've got a set of kind of 7 rules in the book, 7 or 8 rules, which we apply to all the classic recipes that I put in there.
Mm-hmm.
But also you can take away to your weekly shop. You can take these rules away to when you're eating out in a restaurant and choosing your food. Or if you run a food business or a cafeteria or whatever, restaurant, whatever it may be, start thinking about these things when you're creating your menus.
Right.
So that's really why I wanted to write the book, is to get people thinking about these things. And not that we have to go black and white, it's either meat or vegan, but there is somewhere in the middle that is actually very, very good.
Some of the things that occurred to me as you're speaking are who your market should be are the heads of cafeterias, the heads of restaurants, the heads of, you know, one of the successes of industrialized food is how many times the perspective or the lens is shifted onto the individual person, like what you should do at home, because you know, locally, you'll affect globally and whatever. Yeah, sure. But in terms of the economics, I mean, if your book could influence a high school cafeteria, that would have like a really large footprint, right?
Yep. And it already has. So I've been into my children's school and they've...
Amazing.
I give talks to the kids and they've made changes around their snacks and food that they have.
But who cares about the kids? It's the administrators, you know, like kids schmids, who cares?
but yeah, you're absolutely right. So I wanted to show that you can make all the recipes that you know and love, but you can do it and they're going to be way lower carbon. And actually, they're also going to be better for you, because they're going to end up, when you sort of supercharge foods with a bit more plant-based, you avoid red meats, you start cooking healthier food. So the average recipe in the book, out of the 70 recipes I've done, 75% less CO2 per meal. So if you cook each of them in the book, you save half a ton of carbon emissions. But also they have 40% less fat and saturated fat.
Got it.
And 20% fewer calories for the same serving size. So it's stuff that's good for you. It's also good for the planet.
I love it. Now, I am such a shitty host that I'm actually going to insult you right now. I'm going to, okay. You know, it's like, it's I'm a bad host. Like, I just invite you on my show. So why have you not named your book yet? It's going to be the show notes, but what is the name of your book?
That's a good point. Yeah. So Climate Change Kitchen.
Are you saying that again?
Climate Change Kitchen.
Climate Change Kitchen. Thank you. You're showing it to me. Oh, it's a beautiful book. You made the photograph, the cover photo.
I've done all the photography, cover, everything. Yeah, so fight global warming with good food, meat and plant-based, reduced calories, simple cooking, the world's best dishes with a low-carbon twist. And that's what it is. Simple.
That is going to be in the show notes, as well as a previous episode. But definitely, we're going to be naming your cookbook again, because we're going to have to sell the fuck out of it. So anything else you want to say about this particular graph? I mean, like, sure, it's what we know. I mean, if you've been around this world a little, I mean, if you've read a couple of articles and you haven't closed your eyes, it's clear that beef, you know, minced beef or T-bone steaks is the worst.
Yeah. Yeah. Lamb is also bad.
Lamb chicken is also bad.
My messaging is chicken and pork, not too bad in moderation.
Okay.
Near every vegetable is going to be better than meat, regardless of where it's come from in the world.
Right.
And then seafood's probably the tricky one. That's where the rule there is that you want to go for mollusks. So clams,
okay.
Scallops, mussels. They're generally sustainably farmed off coastlines. So it's low emissions. It also filters and cleans the water. So it's really great, actually, for the ocean. Avoid crustaceans, so prawns, lobsters, crab, because they tend to be either farmed at the expense of natural mangroves, so these natural sort of ocean systems that get destroyed, or they kind of trawl the floor of the ocean, which means you dig up all the ocean floor and you destroy all the natural ocean system there and you release CO2. So that's in terms of shellfish. And then in terms of fish, you want to go for fish that basically swim in big schools and are easy to catch, because then you don't burn a load of diesel trying to catch these things. So stuff like herring, mackerel, skipjack, tunas, not bad. So just always make sure it's, you know, responsibly sourced.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what's more difficult to find, things like salmon. Your salmon can be good, but it can also be really, really bad, and it's quite hard to tell. So you're kind of hedging your bets if you try to avoid salmon. And then, you know, obviously all these other sort of big white fish species, which are overfished and also harder to catch, tend to have higher emissions. So those are the kind of rules around fish that we follow. The recipes have no beef or lamb, but we'll use chicken, pork, and those types of lower impact fish and shellfish. Oil's a good one. Mm-hmm. So we massively overuse oil in cooking, I believe. So like 1 tablespoon of oil has something like 70 calories in it. So if you're just glugging oil in, you're adding a ton of calories to your cooking for no real reason. And you're also adding a load of emissions, because oil, yes, it comes from plants, but it's like concentrated plants. It's like you know, the oil that we dig out of the ground, it's concentrated plant. And so it has a relatively high emission. So the only thing I recommend buying for low carbon cooking is a little sprayer, like an oil sprayer. So one or two sprays is the equivalent of a tablespoon, because it disperses that oil over your pan.
Right.
Because all you're using the oil for is to get the pan hotter and cook it and crisp up your food.
Yeah.
And that's like a couple of milliliters instead of 15 mil for a tablespoon.
Sure.
So you're dramatically reducing the amount of calories you're putting in there, the fat content, and you're reducing the emissions as well. So these are the kind of tips, right?
Right. No, I love it. One more time, the title of your book, and then we'll go on to the next photo.
You're good. You get better. Climate Change Kitchen.
Climate Change Kitchen. Available online.
Cool Planet. Available everywhere. Yeah, Amazon, like Waterstones, big box retailers in the US.
Nice.
You can get it in different
Wicked. Places. Well done. Hamburger and fries. Okay, this is great. Okay, so it's a photo of, I guess it's a shot of from your book, I'm assuming. So it says ham hyphen burger and fries. It says each serving carbon, calories, protein, fat, carbs. Serves for prep time 15 minutes, cooking time 30 minutes. I love food. I love cookbooks. I love what you've done. Okay, take it away. Great, great photo.
First off, do you like the photo?
Okay, so one of the things about... Okay, so I am somehow connected to one of the top food photographers in Canada or something like that. or like something weird. And I also know by watching, you know, food porn on TV that, you know, it's like it's a lot of effort to get the right photo and all this stuff. It's a great shot. It's a great shot. It's very saturated. It looks very appetizing, and it looks very kind of, you know, it doesn't look healthy. It looks decadent. It looks tasty. It looks like, you know, I mean, first of all love all food, and this is just burger and fries. I love it.
Yeah. So burger and fries, you know, who doesn't love burger and fries, right? And yeah, hamburger. I've never actually, until I looked at this dish, never questioned why hamburgers are called hamburgers, because they're made from beef, right? But it's because they come from Hamburg in Germany originally.
Right.
So your good old American hamburger is German.
Yeah.
And the fries are obviously French. But the challenge is obviously here, well, we can't be using beef because we've seen the enormous emissions from beef. So your obvious substitute here is pork. But you're going from red meat to white meat. So, you know, whilst I think burgers made from pork taste pretty much just as good as beef burgers, you don't get that visual, like red meat, like, you know, dripping kind of burger look. So all I did was added some, in the recipe, grated beetroot, which is actually amazing because it gives you that real red, deep red hue. And it also keeps it super moist, the burger, so you can cook it. So you're less concerned when you're cooking it about it drying out. That beetroot is moist, a bit of paprika as well, so you give it that sort of earthy hit, that red coloration. You know, it looks like a juicy beef burger. So these are just like little cooking hacks that you can swap that ingredient for something that's way better for the planet, but it's going to taste and look just as good, if not better. So that's what these recipes are all about. I think the picture's got the label on there, so for each serving, we give the carbon, the calories, protein, fat, and carbs.
Yeah.
So you can see what mix of macronutrients you're eating. Remember, you want to be about 10% protein, majority carbs, 20-30% fat. Calories, again, you know, it's important not to overeat. So all the recipes are for a main meal less than 800 calories, which is, you know, the recommended intake. And then the carbon. So this is 560 grams of carbon, which is 90% lower than if you made it out of beef. So it's a massive, massive difference.
Right. Now, this carbon is the carbon emission.
Carbon emissions, yeah.
Because, you know, a carbohydrate is carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen. So, okay, yeah. So just to separate that, the carbon is definitely the carbon emission.
Yes.
Okay.
So yeah, at the end of every recipe, we just say, for instance, this one says, the same serving size has a whopper, 90% lower carbon footprint, 20% fewer calories, 40% less fat than the equivalent beef burger recipe.
Wicked.
So you know instantly the impact of just this one ingredient swap, a couple of little ingredient tweaks, delicious meal, better for you, better for the planet. And that was the idea.
That's great. Okay, so I can't remember if the last time we spoke was over a year ago. Like, how long did it take for you to kind of put this book together and publish it? Like,
yeah, it's probably been about 9 months. Yeah, so
okay.
So I started off with all the original recipes of just the world's favorite dishes. Mm-hmm. So we got, you know, read you a few of them. We've got, you know, classic dishes, things like, you know, spaghetti bolognese. We've got loads of soups in there, starters, piri piri chicken, carbonara, pasta bake, cassoulet, moussaka, loads of curries, fakeaways, so things like chow mein, kung pao, gyros, risottos, bibimbaps. So we got, you know, loads of staples and great foods in there.
Sorry, I have to jump in. You sound like an engineer. I'm not saying this as an insult at all, right? Like, it's in the sense of you're deconstructing the problem and you're coming at it from a sort of a different perspective, right? You're just like, okay, let's look at this food thing, and then how can I tackle this problem or this topic in a way that has more appeal, I guess, or a wider audience?
Yeah.
So why don't you talk about the intellectual process of getting to writing a cookbook as a kind of as a tool, as a solution, right? Like as an engineered solution.
Yeah. Well, it was exactly because of, you know, my failed attempt to go vegan or vegetarian, you know, because if you want to do this really simply, go vegan or vegetarian, right? That's, you're going to win every time on carbon emissions, despite what people say about almonds or avocados.
Right, right.
If you eat mainly vegetables, then you're going to have a huge diet for the planet. Yeah, it's huge. It's huge. There's no denying that.
Yeah.
But I failed at that. And I thought, well, is there a way? And there are lots of other people out there who, yes, they care about climate change. They care about sustainability. They care about the planet. But they're just, you know, we're wedding our ways and we are used to eating what we eat. And they don't care maybe enough to go vegetarian because it's such a big change, and it's a big cultural change.
Yeah, there's that for sure.
I wanted to see, well, how do we create change in those people, which are, remember, 90% of the world, you know, 10% of the planet are vegetarian, less than 1% are vegan, the other 90% or so eat meat.
Yeah.
You know, can we sort of demonstrate how to eat meat better rather than tell them how to eat meat better, demonstrate it through things that they love to eat? And so the process was literally taking a list of all of everyone's favorite dishes, putting up the standardized recipes for them in a database, figuring out what all the emissions and the calories and the macronutrients were, and then going through and doing these ingredient swaps, you know, using what I know about the carbon emissions of different foods from a big old database, and figuring out how we were going to make these dishes lower carbon, taste just as good, if not better.
That was
it.
Fantastic. That's fantastic. It's also very delicate because, you know, what people eat, it's like raising children, you know, it's like when you come in and you start telling people how to live their lives, you know, some people respond very defensively. But I have you done a survey of how many books out there tackle this problem in this particular way? I mean, are there other books like this?
There aren't any, yeah. So there are some, you know, cooking for climate change books out there. There's a handful, but they're all basically vegan or vegetarian cookbooks,
right?
With some good stuff in there about buying seasonally and locally and things like that. There's a really good one. I've forgotten the name now, though. What's it called? Fork Ranger. I would recommend that book. They do a great job, and they've got like an app and a seasonal calendar, and they have one or two recipes with a little bit of meat in, like more as a sort of flavor enhancer, which I like the idea of that. But there's nothing out there which has actual meat dishes, but also looking to be low carbon. So I thought I'd write one. Let's see if
of course. And because people forget really quickly, what's the name of your book again?
Climate Change Kitchen.
Kitchen. 100%. Climate Change Kitchen.
It's an easy one to remember. But so it was just a journey to see if it was doable and see if I could put the book together and see if I could take some photos and do all that aspect of it, which is great fun.
Okay, so look, let's shift gears to that then. Okay, so suddenly you're like, as part of the development, to kind of, you had already written a book, so you kind of went through that process. But then for this book, you're like, okay, I need new skills, which is the photography. So what was the learning curve for somebody who's never done food photography? How would you describe that challenge of food photography?
It's difficult. There's a load of great, like, you know, I read around it. You know, I'm a books guy, so I bought some books on food photography and you know, how to set up light boxes and get the angle of the nice. Light right, depending on whether you want the, you know, the shine coming off some soup, or, you know, what the, you know, color coordination is on the sort of setting that you've put in place, and what the background mm-hmm. look like, things like that. So that all that aspect of it, I found, yeah, it's good. It's interesting. And I found, you know, you take enough shots, you go through all of them. You know, a few of them are going to visually catch your eye and say, yeah, I've got that right. So don't be afraid just to take tons and tons of pictures, is what I learned. What I didn't learn.
It's like writing.
Yeah.
It's a lot of editing. It's a lot of editing.
What I didn't realize was the importance of the angle of the food, or the subtle mm-hmm. angles when you take it. So I was, if I'm taking straight down shots of a circular plate, let's say, in my mind, I'm like, well, it doesn't matter whether I'm taking this, landscape or portrait. I'm going to be able to rotate this after, and I can fit it onto the page how I want to structure the layout.
Yeah.
And then you do that and you're like, okay, I took it landscape, but now I want it portrait to make a full page. And you look at it and you're like, well, something's off. And it's just those subtle angles of how you take the picture, which are embedded in the picture, which you couldn't tell if you're looking at it on a computer, probably. Or the screen of camera. But once you get it laid out into your book, you're just looking and you're like, well, for some reason that looks like it's upside down, or, you know, on its side. Even though there's no visual cue per se that would say that it is, there's just something wrong with it. So that's a mistake that I made through a lot of the photography, in that I should have thought about the layout of the book and the angles at which I took the photos before. I thought, I'm just going to take these from different angles and then we'll make it fit. But yeah, that was really the trickiest part for me.
Okay. Well, as you're saying this, I've got this photo of a really nice looking burger and fries. So let's move on to the next photo.
And I think this is the book, right?
Boom, there we go. So climate.
In case you weren't going to get it in, I was going to get it in.
So let me describe. So it's basically a product shot of your book. Looks great. So climate change kitchen in large white letter is over a plate of what looks like a fig salad.
It's a seared tuna salad.
Ah, seared tuna. Okay, very nice. Meat and plant-based, reduced calorie, simple cooking, fight global warming with good food. Matthew. So good. Okay, so we've already talked a little bit about the book. I'm going to let you... So you chose this image, this graphic of your book, clearly to have it sort of be the focus of our conversation. How do you want to start this part of the conversation?
Well, I mean, we've covered it, right? It's kind of the closing shot, because really what I wanted to cover was, you know, my journey from writing the last book to trying to do veganism to failing at that and saying, can I do something else for those who don't have the willpower to go fully vegan, to, you know, taking this engineering solution and say, let's make stuff that people like but make it better, and then, you know, trying to learn the skills in photography and cooking. And I mean, I've always been a passionate home cook, but I'm not a professionally trained chef, which is why I think, you know, that comes across in the recipes, is that they are easy recipes, they don't take too long to cook. And actually, I've put in there a lot of, so one of the important points as well that we make in our sort of 8 tips on low carbon cooking is don't mess it up and don't waste it.
So right.
In each recipe, I know all the areas where you're going to go wrong in cooking a particular dish, whether it be putting in too much of a strong ingredient, you know, like people, you know, home cooks tend to just chuck a load of garlic. You're like, I like garlic. Let's put a whole bulb of garlic in, or let's squeeze a load of lemon juice in, or let's put in loads of this really strong flavor. be careful with that. Chili, mm-hmm. obviously, putting too much chilies and things. You know, always put a little bit in. You can add it later, taste it. It's important. You know, right. At home, you don't taste it, do you? You know, if you watch the chef programs on telly, they're constantly tasting the food.
Constantly tasting, yes.
That's a real skill, right? Because when we cook at home, we just blindly follow a recipe and assume it's going to taste good. No, this is a process. Like, it's not science. It is a bit science, but it's also an art. And the art is tasting and figuring out as you are cooking the dish how to make it taste good.
I really love that. So there's something, you know, really, I mean, I'm going to sound kind of poncy by saying this. I'm only a little poncy. Okay, so there's something really delightful, really sweet, really endearing about the fact that you dork out, you geek out, you apply your scientific knowledge to sort of deconstruct the problem of getting to net zero. Really amazing and inspiring. And then you're like, okay, you know what? Okay, that's one approach. Now I'm going to approach it from a different perspective. And in fact, I'm going to fess up. I'm going to be like, I tried being vegan and I couldn't do it really. And it was too hard. And I'm sorry if you hear the dogs, a bunch of dogs all around me barking. But actually, you're putting yourself out there. And there, it does take courage to put yourself out there. And especially with a cookbook or any book. So much respect, because I know that there's the effort of putting together a book, but it's also the effort of going into something that's not really your comfort zone.
Yeah. No, it's definitely not my comfort zone. you know, I like to cook at home, but it's a pressure creating a recipe and then getting other people to cook it, right?
You
feel like if something goes wrong, it's your fault. You know, you haven't written the recipe properly, So I was always very conscious of that, writing each recipe. You know, I think a lot of cookbooks are too, very short on description, and they don't think about what's going to go wrong because they're professional chefs probably, and they've spent 5 years at some sort of Michelin star, you know, food school, you know, learning all of these basics, and it's so ingrained in them they don't think about it. Because I still have, you know, I have to think about it. I know what's going to go wrong. So it's a disadvantage, but it's also an advantage in that respect. And yeah, there is something about putting it out there. But I wasn't even in my comfort zone writing the first book, right? It's being back at school again and having your homework marked by people when you put it out. That's the thing.
Yeah. So you put it out in the world, and then you're, in a way, you open yourself up to some kind of criticism. So listen, I want to say something, because there's something about being vegan that really touches something in people's.
Oh, it triggers people. It's so divisive.
It really does. Divisive.
If I could pick two things that's incredibly divisive, climate change and veganism.
And because I'm, but here's the thing, like. The reason why I love Thailand so much, and that the Thai Buddhist sort of approach, which is just do your best, just don't be an asshole, just do your best. Because some things that really get on my nerves is somebody, for example, who's really into companion animals, like protecting companion animals, and really like dogs and cats, and really, you know, isn't it so important to really extend your sense of compassion for you know, these poor innocent dogs and cats. And so, you know, like, I know many vegans who have like four dogs, and it's like, well, what about their carbon footprint? You know what I mean? Like, life is messy. And so I'm just like, just do your best.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And I think it's important to show people, not tell people. Maybe that's a good way of putting it, right?
Right.
People don't want to be told what to eat. They want what they eat to be regulated by governments. And they don't want your taxes put on beef so that everything that they want becomes more expensive. But if you can show them there's a better way, or a different way, let's not say better, but we say different way, which is lower impact and just as great, and maybe an option they haven't thought of, You know, I think it's that kind of softer approach, which I think is going to be work better for that, you know, that kind of cultural change that is required in food systems and agriculture.
Right. So as somebody looking at getting to net zero and the carbon footprint of food, have you looked at things like meat substitutes, like Impossible, you know, Impossible Burgers, or?
Yeah, absolutely. I think they're a great idea. There's lots of there's like Memphis Meats, Impossible Meats. Yeah, there's companies basically taking plants and using modern processing methods to turn them into a meat equivalent. Some of them go a little further and add things like heme, which is the substance that you find in blood. Mm-hmm. They derive it from plants or fungus, and that gives it that kind of irony meat taste, you know what I mean?
Yep.
That you get out of a steak. So that's kind of, these are like, that's the forefront of what's kind of commercially available on that.
Right.
Then in the future, there are technologies looking at sort of cellular cultures of meat.
Yep.
So you would take cells of animals, but instead of growing them in the animal, you grow them in a vat.
Yep.
With a nutrient fluid. You can structure them around kind of a seaweed membrane if you wanted to make a steak. So you can grow out different bits of fat or protein or muscle fiber or whatever it is. You know, and this can be done now. It can't be done at a reasonable price. That price will come down.
Yeah.
But I think that's going to be very much, I think it will eventually work. You will see some companies doing it, but I think it's always going to be the premium end.
It's going to
be expensive. You know, at the moment, it's buying the culture, which is the most expensive part of it, because they're buying these cultures, which are typically used by the pharmaceutical industries to grow drugs. So they're super high quality, basically. So there's an opportunity to bring the costs down in that. So yeah, like a cheaper culture for food growth, like meat-based food growth. But I think we also need cultural change. And I think that's a bigger driver. And, you know, if you look around the world, the big meat-eating countries, you know, Europe, US, Australia, Latin America, you know, they roughly need to halve meat consumption, which will allow the, number one, a lot of the developing countries around the world need to up their protein consumption somewhat. And remember, you can get, obviously, protein from plants, the great source of protein, things like soy and things like that. But if the big meat eaters could halve their meat consumption, which is way too high already, it's at an unhealthy level, then you can have a little uplift in developing countries, but you can reclaim some of that agricultural land, and that helps us on that journey towards net zero agriculture.
100%. And look, I can't avoid it. I'm trying to avoid it, but I can't avoid using the pun of the low-hanging fruit is to actually use your book to just cook a sort of, just use new habits of cooking with a lower climate footprint recipe, you know? I love it.
Yeah.
I had no idea.
You know, you'll cook these recipes. You know, I have a couple of pages at the start with a couple of those charts that I've given you, but I didn't want this to be a big, not, it wasn't meant to be like my last book. It's not 400 pages on exactly how to do it. It's 2 pages on what are our 8 rules. Why have we done this? And what are the 8 rules? 2 or 3 pages.
And it's just wait.
But each recipe,
what are the 8 rules?
You learn the tips. The 8 rules. So these rules you were talking about for low carbon cooking. So let's go through them.
You buried the lead. You buried the lead. Start with the 8 rules.
We did the 8 rules.
Okay, good. Go for it.
Number one, 800 is the magic number. So
nice.
800 grams of CO2, 800 calories for a main meal. Why? That's a recommended calorie intake. And number two, that's more than 50% lower carbon emissions than your average meal today. So that's the boundary that I set for myself on every meal serving.
800.
Eat your greens, green your eats. So we always want to be switching some meat for more plant-based stuff. That's always going to work. If you can do it, do it. Because that's always a surefire way of lowering the carbon footprint and making it healthier. That's not to say we're not going to use meat, and we do use meat. But I think there are certain dishes which are better vegetarian. And if that's the case, they will be vegetarian. Choice meats, meat choices. This is what we've been speaking about. No beef and lamb. And I'm not saying never eat a steak. Just have a steak, enjoy it once a month or, you know, but don't cook beef mince every day. Use pork mince, turkey mince, chicken mince, whatever it may be instead. So yeah, choosing sort of chicken and pork over lamb and beef. Plenty of fish in the sea. So that's what we're talking about. You know, choose mollusks, not crustaceans. Choose fish like herring, mackerel, skipjack, tuna that are sustainably sourced. Be more careful around sort of whitefish and salmon because they can be okay, but they can also be bad. Spray, don't drizzle your oil. Yeah. So use less oil because using 4 sprays instead of a tablespoon is 75% lower carbon emissions and calories. And then dairy. It's one we haven't touched on maybe, but you know, the cow is no longer kin. So look at dairy alternatives. Yeah. You know, I love oat milk. I can't drink cow's milk in my coffee anymore. It tastes weird.
Yep.
So I tend to use oat milk for my like hot drinks, cereal now, but also, you know, if you're making a bechamel sauce, use oat milk. It's actually way better. It's creamier. Or soy milk, if that's your choice. Same for yogurts. And then cheeses, you know, I don't like vegan cheese. I think there's a way to go.
Some are good. Cheese. Some are good.
Really? I haven't come across a good one yet, but, it's things like if you're going to use a lot of cheese, go for a soft cheese because it uses 4 times less milk to make.
Ah.
Or if you want to use like Parmesan, I use Parmesan loads of the dishes, but you're putting a very small amount because it packs such a big flavor. So those are the types of things you want to be thinking about. Use it, don't lose it. All the recipes, I tried to think of a smarter way of doing this, but actually I couldn't come up with it. But all of the recipes tend to use standardized ingredient pack sizes. Do you know when you cook and you're often left with, you know, half a pack of this vegetable and a half open like bit of sauce that's going to go off in 2 days?
Sure.
And it all gets thrown out. So I tried to base everything on standardized, you know, pack sizes that you would get from your supermarket or whatever.
Right.
So don't waste. Try avoid waste, obviously.
Yep.
And then smash it, don't trash it. So this is what I'm talking about, like chili. You know, go easy on the chili. You can always add more later. Lemon, garlic, these strong flavors. Actually, great little tip I learned was if you heat garlic in a dry frying pan, like a garlic clove, for like 5 minutes, so it heats it through, it kills the enzyme that gives you that really strong garlic aftertaste. If you're using raw garlic in like dressings and salads and stuff, that was an amazing cooking tip that I'd never known.
That's great.
So you can put the garlic in there. You get the flavor when you're eating it, but you don't go away thinking, ah, I can still taste that weird garlic dish in my mouth.
Right.
And yeah, so those are the 8 rules. Is that 8? I don't know. I said 8. 3.
Matthew, 4, 5, wicked.
6, 7, 8. Yes.
You crushed it like garlic. I love it. Well done.
Crush it like garlic.
Dude, thank you so much. This has been so good.
Cool.
Thank you. We're done.
Hopefully you've learned a couple of things.
I have. Yes.
I've told you. I've showed you. We've showed you the charts and the photographs.
Yep.
We haven't told you. We've discussed it.
You have crushed it.
And yeah.
Yeah. So thank you so much, man. I will catch you the next time with your next book, which will be completely different.
Quantum Consciousness.
Nice.
And the Nature of Reality. This one's got a 10-year lead time, though. I've got to relearn quantum mechanics again. I've forgotten it all.
Okay, Matthew. Well, listen, on that note, have a really great day. Thank you so much. This has been great.
You're welcome. Cheers.
Tuning it raw?
Yes. Shooting.